Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast. Thank you for listening. If you enjoy the show, please do rate, review and subscribe. I know every podcast in the world asks you to do that, sorry, but it does genuinely help. It sort of like makes it move up the chart, and then, you know, there might be a griefster out there being like, oh, that looks fun. That's, you know, or someone not in the club. You're all welcome. Everybody's welcome. Thank you so much if you've done it already. You can have a tick. Tick. There you go. This week, I'm talking to clown Lauren Silver. Yes, Lauren is a clown, and she actually explains what that means in the chat, so I won't go into it now. She's performed with Tall Stories, Gonzo Moose, and she also trained at the world-famous clown school in Paris with Philippe Gollier. She came in to talk to me about her dad, Alan, who died when she was 17. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with clown, and she asked me to say that. Not ask me, but that is your job. Clown, Lauren Silver. Yeah. But I'm so excited. Did you see how excited I was?
Yeah,
about
I know.
It?
Your eyes lit up. It's so nice.
Clown. I feel like it seems really exciting having a clown in the room. It's so much nicer than like, they're a writer, so you can imagine what the next hour
Yeah, they look like. Not that I'm dressed like a clown.
She's got a red nose, huge shoes. I don't know what she came in costume. So you're a clown?
Yes.
I mean, if people don't know much about clowning, it's now not like red nose, big shoes. It's moved on, right?
I'm wearing quite a sparkly jumper, but
yeah, it's very sparkly.
Just life.
Yeah. What? Tell me. What's happening with clowning right now?
What's up with clowning? The comparison I usually make for now modern day is someone like Mr. Bean.
Yeah.
He's a clown, even though he's kind of a physical comedian.
Yeah.
A physical performer. It all started in sort of Commedia and. Commedia dell'arte and sort of
but lately it's got quite fashionable, a bit like improv in a way, like it's always been there, but suddenly newspapers are like, what's this thing?
And I think there's Lecoq, and there is a school
that makes me laugh every time. Jacques Lecoq in Paris,
which is a bit more of a sort of probably a more serious. I am doing no justice to any clowns out there. I just apologise.
Isn't that how a clown should answer? If a clown was like, here's my thesis,
here's
like,
a very serious. Although I know some serious clowns, and you meet them and they're very serious in your life.
Yeah, someone said you can have like sad clown or happy clown.
So it's the essence of clowning is what, from my understanding, so I trained with Gollier, who's a big, scary, amazing teacher in Paris, and he has a school just out of outside of Paris. And the teaching is about what is inherently funny about you as a person.
Yeah, so it's more about like you rather than you sitting down and going, I've written something real funny about Brexit.
Yeah. There's a time and a place for it. Maybe clowns should talk about Brexit.
I would love to see a Brexit clown show.
We should make that.
That'd be a good Edinburgh show. Mm. Someone could pay Europe and someone could pay Britain and they could just like fall about.
And then custard pie each other's
feet. That would get 5-star Scotsman.
Okay, you heard it first. Next Edinburgh.
Next, we need to apply now because that gets out there. Someone else is going to do it.
Oh, quick, talk about your ideas now and then make them.
Yeah, you're going to see university being like, guys, they're doing Brexit the Clown musical. That was our idea.
Damn it. There's like wonderful companies like Spy Monkey. Yeah. And the idea is that you look about inherently what's funny about you.
Yeah.
And that is so much of what the training, you can apply clowning to lots of different performances like classical theatre and Shakespeare and Greek theatre. And you train a lot when you sort of go to Paris, they do a lot of classes in different types. But specifically, I work a lot in something called Le Jeu, which is the game. And it's all about play and fun and light. And there's no fourth wall, like you talk directly to the audience as you would sort of with stand up. But I sort of fell into doing it as a job from doing improv and acting and theatre and sort of walked away going, I don't know what I want to do.
Yeah, because we both do improv. That's how I've known you for a long time, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Now I think about it.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And when Lauren came in, she put her notebook down.
Yeah.
And she said, well, tell me, why have you brought a notebook?
So I've brought a notebook and some notes because I can't remember a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And what's actually been kind of really wonderfully cathartic about knowing I was doing this podcast was that I have spoken a lot about my dad over the past. I speak about him quite open. I'm very open about talking about death, as you are, which is why
we're here.
I can't remember much.
See, that's really interesting. So when you put the notebook down and said you can't remember, I was thinking, it made me laugh because I was like, I didn't know it would have been that long. Because for somewhere in my head, I was like, oh, I think she's like a 2-3 year person. So I'm coming up to 20 years.
Oh my God.
And
yeah.
I am in exactly the same problem. I can't remember.
Yeah.
How do you feel about not being able to remember? Is it because I'm finding it quite hard that there's things I'm like, oh, it's starting to be very foggy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm very open about talking about death. And so I will look at a logical reason and go, well, there must be a reason why I must have blocked a lot of that stuff out and said, oh, well, I don't know why. You know, I don't remember what happened. And now that's probably because I was 17. And so I probably put a bit of a shutdown mode, but that is still old enough to know what's going on and, you know, remember personalities and situations that happened. But it feels like the year that my dad died, sort of the build-up and the lead-up to it, I kind of just can't remember. And then there's moments where I can remember bits and pieces about my dad. Now I can answer questions and like know stuff about him, but there's moments where I'm like, oh God, I don't really remember sort of stuff. And I think there must be a defence, like a barrier that our bodies and our brains do where we...
Yeah, I don't know, because I am in the same position of like I was 15. Yeah. So there's obviously, if people ask you, what was he this? You could be like, oh yeah, it was this. But then I'm finding as well, the more I talk about it, actually sometimes the foggier it's getting.
Oh really? Because I thought, do you not think that it is?
Well, it depends. Some things I think once I have this thing, maybe it's an improviser thing, sometimes once I've said something, it just goes.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like once I've shared a memory, it's like, and it's gone.
Goodbye.
And once I'm like, because I really remember it, I can really see it. And then my brain goes, well, that's glad we can let go of that. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
It's really clogging up our brain. So I'm finding like and I'm obviously hitting, I mean, 20 years is, you know, I can't do that. Six years ahead of you? Yeah, like, so that is, you know, another chunk of time. But I'm finding it hard that, you're right, like, just chunks of life you can't remember. But then I think my theory is so much other stuff has happened.
Yeah.
So you just can't remember.
And how do you hold on to the bits that are?
Yeah.
So I probably, one of the reasons why I sort of was chatting to you about this at first was because I have something called death anxiety, which one of the things that I've talked to my, so I've been seeing a therapist for years. Get therapy. It's great.
So
it's
good.
The best. And I know that you've just started.
I just joined the club of therapy. Well, yeah, I love, but you're saying death anxiety and I'm like, I think I have that, but no one's ever, I didn't know it was that. Is that what you constantly think, everyone's going to die?
Yes.
Oh my God.
All the time.
So is there like a specific?
Well, not so, So,
because let me tell you
one today. So, sort of bringing my work and my life together. One of the things that I've done is I've made a solo clown show called Surprise, and how I open the show is I talk about the fact I sort of begged my therapist to give me a label that I could use to make my show, because my show's about sort of social anxiety and anticipation. As if I hate surprise parties, and that's what the show's about. But what I sort of opened the show by saying that my therapist says that I've got something called generalized anxiety disorder with subtypes of social anticipation and death anxiety, which then I go on to say
we're literally interchangeable.
Yes, we're the same
we can do the both jobs.
Person.
What do you need? Yeah.
And I think it obviously as well just makes me a really fun person to hang out with all the time. So much fun. But where that comes from was because I started seeing a therapist when my dad passed away. And that was probably the first time I decided that I needed to go and speak to somebody.
Okay.
And because of that, that was a lot of bits and pieces that sort of had gone on that I can talk about. But one of the things that still happens now, almost 15 years later, is that I have a complete fear that people around me, all the time, people that I love, I'm going to lose them.
That's constant. Like, phone goes, anything, I'm like, they're dying.
This is it.
They're dead.
Yeah.
Or anyone's like, oh, so I need to, you're dying. So that's what you're going to tell me.
My mum's not allowed to call me and leave me, not leave a text saying, or not text me saying everything's all right. Because I will, if I get a missed call from her, I will assume that someone's died. You know, if my mum, because she used to say, oh, call me back. And I'd be like, who's dead?
Who's dead? Someone's died. Yeah, why? Am I dead?
Who's dead? What's happened? I dying? Are you dying? Are you calling? Where are you calling me from?
Yeah, so, I always think that. Always. Yeah. Convinced. Absolutely convinced. Like, as soon as they open their mouth, my stomach goes, and I think, okay, so they're going to tell me they're dying, so I'm ready. I'm ready.
I'm ready to grieve.
Yeah.
And so there is, I think the build-up from that probably came from the fact that, like, my therapist will say, but that's probably because it's a complete knock-on effect from what you've had around you for so long that you're used to things happening. So, like, so much of my anxiety generally is based on being in control. That a lot of it is to do with when you lose somebody and
you're
out of control. And that's where we're trying to grasp at straws to sort of...
Were you anxious before he died?
I don't remember being. So I feel like I don't... I mean, my family are inherently, we're Jews. So we invented one part of anxiety.
That's already on the cards.
It is. Yeah, so that was always going to be the case. And I think probably, grandpa and my grandmother and family members have levels of it. And I'm very interested in it because I'm very high functioning. And so I use a lot of my show, like specifically I talk about, it's about making light and making joy about sort of anxiety and trying to learn to live and to laugh with it as opposed to just spend the whole time being like, oh my God.
Yeah.
But the death anxiety, I've had to sort of make light of it because it is a constant. So I sort of like constantly think my boyfriend's dying or is dead.
Oh, yeah,
and he, for example, like the nearest thing I could talk about is we had an argument the other day about nothing important. I just like had a bit of a bicker on the phone. And as I went to hang up, I was like, that could be the last conversation I have with him.
Yeah.
So now I have to apologise because I don't want him to be annoyed at me and I don't want to remember. But I was like, but I'm still cross at the thing
every
that we've just...
fucking time. Leave the house. I think this could be the last goodbye.
Yeah,
make sure goodbye, you say it. Love you, goodbye, because otherwise you'll think every phone get, oh my God, all the time.
Yeah, all the time.
I'm like, but what's funny... My husband is pretty bad as well.
Is he?
He lost both his parents. So we both have this slightly like, it could be that we're all dying. So it kind of encourages it slightly, but also means at least he understands. But every goodbye, I think. Imagine if that's the last time that you see them. So make sure you like smiling and stuff. Don't end it on a row.
Finish with a memory.
Like
of a lovely moment.
This was it. They saw you waving and you were smiling. They didn't see you crying thinking, God, I think he's going to die.
Which is, it happens. It happens.
God,
I'm.
Time,
it's
constant.
So lovely. It's so lovely to meet more people that.
Oh, it's just gone. But see, this is my thing.
Okay.
I thought everybody had it.
Yeah. No.
So I was like, I don't have a problem. Everybody thinks everyone's going to die, right? We all worry about it. And then I've only just discovered people don't think like this.
No.
I really thought this is like being a human. You just, you always think people are going to die because everyone's so vulnerable.
Yeah. No.
How can you not worry about that? I honestly didn't know.
No, it's everybody. Most people like, oh my gosh, my poor boyfriend is often put through a lot of stuff. This is his thing where he'll be like, you know, oh, so the thing that my friends do now if they're late is they'll text me and say, I'm not dead. Like, that is a thing.
Wow.
That, and it's just not, you know, not like by 5-10 minutes, but it became a point where I was like, I'll still just sort of put it along my day and I'll be like, oh, Sarah's not here. Okay, well, she probably died.
Yeah,
all right,
yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That's what's happened now. Am I?
I feel like I'm like, normal. Like,
yeah,
normal.
This
you
is
think
a normal
that
thing.
All day, normal.
The most memorable thing that I have
not
talked
normal,
about. But it is, no, but it
well,
is
two
normal
of us,
in our
it's
world.
It's two of us, so... At the moment, it's 100% normal. The population of this room can say
yes. Oh my God, imagine normal. Every the population was like
I
this.
Don't know if it'd be good if we were all
I don't think so. It is a balance. But the thing where I realised it's got really bad, but it, probably in a humorous way, is when, oh God, I'm talking about this on a podcast. I've talked about this before. I'm so sorry, Stuart. Stuart was on the toilet for a while. And
I hear you, brother.
We've been there, mate. I had sort of called his name to, because I think we were leaving and he didn't answer. Because
he was thinking, just give it a sec, love.
I'm just...
Please.
Just
got a bit of a situation here.
just having some time. And he didn't answer. And so I was like, oh. And called his name again and he didn't answer. And I was like, oh, okay. It's been about 6 or 7 minutes and he's still not that long, really, on a level of toilet time, but... Long enough for me to go, he's died.
Dead, yeah.
And then I sat there going, okay, what do I do? And started like thinking about my grieving process, planning what I would do. Of course.
Of course, of course.
You know, very in tune with my brain. What do I need to do? How do I tell his parents? Something terrible. Okay. And started to basically plan and think about now, how do I grieve for somebody that has lost his dad on the toilet for all the different reasons. Like, in my brain, he died lots of different ways and I planned it all out. And then, you know, eventually he comes out the loo and I was like looking at him like, oh. And he was like, okay, we need to have a chat about... This is when it got really bad.
I was like... I was doing a shit.
We need to... I was on Instagram.
In a way, it was a death. But not for me. For something else that day.
Yeah.
God, so, yeah, I hear you. That's exactly... My mum has got it really bad. Like we both have it. That's kind of. But like, at the moment, and I'm sure she won't mind me saying this. Like, if she rings and I don't text back within 5 minutes, I get this text. Are you all right? What's happening?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But what I keep trying to say is, like, once you have a baby, you just can't get back quickly because you're like, I'm just dealing with this. So now I like half text, like, you know, badly spelled, like, yes, fine, just trying to get a nappy on, and someone's screaming. She's like, you just have to, or she'll ring. She'll just start ringing. What are you doing? What's happening? And I'm like, I was worried about. I was worried about your daughter. I was like, she's fine. She's fine. I just literally, like, I was washing up.
Oh.
So I now have it from her. So I now understand what it's like.
When you see it from the other side.
So let's start at the beginning.
Yes.
So how did he die? What happened?
So my dad had chronic lymphatic leukemia.
Okay.
Which is a blood cancer in the blood. And he was diagnosed in the May. So he'd sort of found like a lump and went to the hospital and got checked out. And they said, so with this type of leukemia, you live with it forever.
Yeah.
You're not meant to die with it. You're meant to just sort of live your life. Mm. And there's still people that we sort of know back in Liverpool who have it and are still living and the same age as my dad. Yeah, so we found that out. So my parents found that out and then they told us. My brother was 19, I was 17, and my sister was, she must have been 14. And we basically were just told, like, this is what you've got. He's got this and he'll live his life and things might be a bit different, but generally... This is just the way, what he's got. He's not well. And we were like, okay, well, that's rubbish. But, you know, we're very open, family and sort of talked a lot about it. And then we're just like, okay, well, let's live our life. And my dad was always a very, like, he was very busy, very, very active, very, like, huge personality sort of. So it kind of didn't stop him. He just sort of went about his days really. And then in the August they got a sort of blood result. I think they were just doing like a routine blood test, and so it was the May bank holiday weekend, and then in the August some bloods came back and basically said that it had mutated, and that instead of having what he thought would be like 15-20 years, if not more, he'd have 5. And
God.
So my parents, and oh gosh, my mum told me that they had this really amazing like hematologist guy usually who was sort of taking it, but that day they had this guy and because
the supply teacher basically
which is exactly what it was. I think he was like, so you've only got, you know, you've got 5 years. Sorry, I've got to go to a meeting now. So if you want to have a chat, gotta go. My mum was like, can we ask you some questions? He was like, yep, just call my secretary or blah, blah, blah.
Wow.
Like, and because my parents had gone, I think they'd chosen to go on private and we could do that, which we were lucky enough. But it meant that there was no sort of aftercare. There was no Macmillan nurses. There was nothing. So I sort of was talking to my mum about it and it was... That was obviously a really difficult thing. I think they just sort of stood in the corridors of the hospital just staring at each other and sort of then went home and told some family friends. But they basically chose not to tell me and my brother and my sister.
Wow.
And even to this day, I actually really don't feel bad about that they did that. Which is a really strange, like when I've sort of told people.
Yeah, because that could cause a lot of anger and confusion.
Yeah, and then basically what happened, then he passed away in the October of the same year.
Wow.
So actually he didn't. So
he didn't even
really
get the 5 years.
He didn't get the 5 years. And I think that's probably why my parents, I think they really talked long and hard about it. I know they did. And they were, my mum's has dealt with so much stuff. Like I even now feel like I don't regret that she didn't, because obviously I've been reading Julia Samuels.
Saint Julia Samuel. Our book, Grief Works, that we turn to. Yeah.
Obviously been reading that. And I think there's a lot about being open and being sharing. And I definitely agree with everything she says and sort of listen to obviously the other podcasts that we've talked when listening to you interview other people. But there was really something in that decision being made by my parents that I don't regret, because I think I don't know whether my dad would have, maybe the quality of life would have been, we would have spent so much time saying goodbye over the months when he was still sort of all right at this point. He didn't actually really get ill until the October.
So they find out in the August.
Yeah.
And like you said, it carries on being kind of normal. So I guess as kids, you don't really...
So in May, he was diagnosed.
Yeah.
And so, it was normal then. And we were just like...
But then the August,
they found 5 years.
It's worse.
Yeah.
But like life for you seems normal.
Mm.
So, but when he gets to October, is there a point when you as children are like, oh, something's not right?
Yeah.
And so it wasn't like when he died, you weren't like, what?
Yeah,
like,
you said. Yeah. Well, I think we started to realise... So it wasn't sudden as well.
Yeah.
I think if he just then dropped dead, we were like, hold on a second. And it's funny because I think when I was probably talking last night actually about memories of the year, the only thing I can massively remember without having to then dig deep into other people's memories is like my dad napping a lot, and which he didn't really do because he was such a busy man. Like he had loads of businesses and I used to think he was a drug dealer for a while because I didn't know what he did. And I was like, what does dad do? Why do we live here? And just didn't know. He wasn't. He
made that very clear to authorities. He was not a drug dealer.
You're listening. Yes. So for me, I just remember like climbing into my parents' bed and like going for a nap with like napping in the same bed as him once. That's one of the only memories I have of that sort of year.
Wow.
Because I think that's what we were talking about at the beginning, like putting sort of blocks up.
Yeah, yeah.
So when he started to get ill, I think what had happened was he started to get a bit of a sore throat. I think he was struggling to breathe and was getting, like, his breathing was sore. And so he went to see our doctors, our family GPs, who were just the best. Oh my gosh, I just feel we were so lucky to have such amazing family GPs, really, who were just extraordinary. And they were really worried and were just like, actually, this isn't looking good. So they sent him to the private hospital and he was in there for a bit and just basically was deteriorating quite quickly over 10 days and couldn't breathe. So they sent him to go and have a tracheostomy in the Royal Liverpool, which is where you put a tube in the throat to help you breathe. And then then basically when they went to do that, he just didn't survive it. Sort of that, and it was over a matter of 10 days that had happened. So it was very quick over the time, but over the sort of, it's funny because I feel like my memories of my dad aren't contained in that 1 year.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably that's probably, thinking about it, why I don't remember much, because I probably went, I don't want to remember my dad being this sort of slower, yeah, ill man, which he probably was, and very sad. And
I found afterwards, like directly afterwards, all I could remember for years was sick dad.
Yeah.
Like it stayed with me for like maybe two and a half, 3 years. Mm. Like I couldn't, definitely the first year, I literally couldn't remember him being healthy, even though he'd only been ill for 2 months.
Yeah.
And then slowly that sick person really faded. And now I struggle to remember the sickness.
Yeah.
Whereas at the time it was like, I could only see him yellow and in this tracksuit because he was ill. And again, very active person.
Yeah.
Didn't normally do that. And then that I think because you're sort of traumatised by it, it sort of fades after a while. But you're so traumatised that you're like, and goodbye.
Goodbye memories.
Never want to see that memory again.
Yeah.
Wow, but that May to October is so fast.
Very, very fast, yeah.
So you had been told he's sick but it's fine, and then suddenly,
well, that he would be ill and there'd be ill stages. I don't ever remember going, oh my god, hold on a second, you said,
yeah,
I don't maybe I did, you know, it was,
I guess you were probably just in shock,
yeah,
and it's like, what, hang on, what?
But there was I think other people have talked about it. I had a terrible regret that I went away over the time that my dad was ill. Because I think he said to me, I'm going to be fine, like, I'll see you. I went away for a weekend to this, like, Jewish youth camp weekend. Even now I'm like, what was I doing? Yeah. But I think I was, like, co-managing this weekend.
And also, I can imagine as a parent now being, like, so stressed.
Mm.
Like, great, Lauren, be away.
Go
that's
do
so
that
good.
Thing.
She can have a nice time.
Yeah.
Like, everyone just trying to cope.
Yeah.
And just being like, that'll be good for you and we can have some time.
Yeah,
and
we'll see you when you get back. And I always, and like, well, see you when, you know, it was that very
so
much.
Were you there when he
so
died?
I wasn't there. So, not when he was sort of compos mentis and before he'd gone. So, really, my last memory of my dad was sort of lying in hospital bed being like, I'll see you later. Like, I'll see you when the... So I went away for the weekend and was staying at my boyfriend at the time, and then, like, went to this, like, Jewish weekend where we talk, learn about things, and sort of had put a lot of work into it. And apparently at that point, that was very important to me to go to
yes,
that. But probably not that important, but my parents were like, you've worked very hard.
Yeah.
I'm, like, the worst Jew ever. I can't believe, like, that was a thing that I went and did. But so then I always remember, like, I was on the train on the way back, and I was my friend Harry, his mum is our GP. Both his parents were our GPs. And so when we got to the station, got to Lime Street Station in Liverpool, Marion was there to basically be like, you've got to come. And they basically, that was then when he had gone into having an operation, the tracheostomy,
right,
and then just didn't come out and never recovered from it. And
did you see him after?
Yes, yeah, so we got to go into the room, but he was basically under. So I never really got to talk to him or say like a proper goodbye to him with him being awake. But I then, after that, lived with so much regret for going away and actually had to deal with that for huge amounts, for seeing a therapist and stuff about so much blame. And even now, when I was talking to my mum over the weekend about it, my mum was like, I really don't want you to blame yourself. Mm. Like, I still don't ever want you to hang on to those things, because they were the right things at the time for you, and actually it probably could have been worse for you to be there, because actually it just sounded so horrible for my mum. I think what we thought was, my mum thought, was that he'd have this tracheostomy, he'd come out and maybe he'd live a little bit longer.
Yeah.
So no one thought that this was going to be...
No one thought this... It was, again, it's that thing of like, you're doing something to help someone.
Yeah.
Not to...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know that my mum's priority was always us and... But how we, my dad, like, how it would be all right for us, because it was, she sort of talking to her again this week, because I've sort of had to revisit a lot, wanted to sort of revisit a lot of stuff and ask my mum a lot of things I don't remember. And she and I talked about it a lot this week, and she shouldered so much, because I think she was just so protective of us. She's an incredible woman. Like, that's the strength of where, I suppose, where we've sort of talked about, you just become quite, well, this is what I'll do. But she, just...
And that just makes, I know, Saint Julia talks about that a lot, that the parent left, and I hate saying this, because I feel like if your parent left, did a shit job, that is awful. But the parent left does make a huge,
yeah,
a huge difference. And when I spoke to Julia, I had like accidental free counselling session about what I did. When I was talking about things my mum did, she was like, oh, yeah, well, that would have been really helpful. And I was like, oh, yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
Again, you think, oh, it's just my mum doing what she's doing. But, like, having somebody be like, I am here and fixed.
Yeah, and this is what we... And then, amazing. So then when we were in the... Then we were in the hospital, and then we sort of knew, I think, at this point, that he wasn't going to come out of it, and the doctors knew that. So then the doctor said to my mum, well, we need to have a talk about whether we turn the life support machine off. Mm. And my mum said, I want my kids to be in the room for that. So, because she then felt that that was an important thing that we all talked about together.
Yeah.
And my sister was probably, you know, my sister was 14. She didn't say anything. For, again, these are all things I don't remember my mum was saying. But we all sort of agreed together. And I think my mum felt that that was an important thing to say. This is what, you know, have the doctor talk to us all. And there was no forcing of it. But we could see, like, he was never going to have a quality of life. He wasn't really going to. It would just be the way he was. And then the weird things happen where human behaviour's weird, where we all sort of realised that this was going to be the goodbye. And there were loads of people that had come to the hospital, loads of family members and friends that had sort of heard about it. And I remember, first of all, asking the nurse to clean my dad's tracheostomy because it was just covered in gross, and being like, my dad doesn't like looking not very nice, so could you clean him up and make him look nice? And then I would go and like welcome people from the waiting room and be like, who would like to say goodbye to Alan? I was 17 and I was like, welcome. Please, like his PA or something, like Alan.
It's a job. It's a job.
Yeah.
And you can smell a job and you're like, oh, great, I can do that. I can do that.
Yeah.
Look at you. I'm not sad. I'm useful.
Look at me helping.
Look at me doing stuff. Yeah. I mean, look, you know, I'm really on it. Someone's dying. I don't need that. That's nothing to do with me. Yeah. My job is bringing people into the room. And look how well it's going.
Mm-hmm.
It's going so well.
We all good? We all right?
Oh, and God, yeah. Anything to be
fix,
in control.
Fix.
Like, I understand what my job is here because I don't know what the fuck's going on.
Because it's grasping control, and that's so much about, obviously, where levels of my anxiety anyway come from, but also just trying to grasp onto things that you can help. And actually, like, I look back on that as a sort of, like, real care for my 17-year-old self going, all right, Laura, like, that's what you... So I then... You know, there wasn't like I didn't accept. There was moments with my family who were utterly incredible. It's my uncle Ian, who was absolutely astounding and really helped me through. Like, was like all the family were just amazing. But just going, I just remembered like going in. It's my dad's mate Roger, and I was like, right, Roger. So it might be a bit shocking for you, but I'll be there. Yeah, this man, and obviously walking in and seeing my dad just like on a bed was pretty. It's like horrific for anybody who's not been through the process of seeing him up until
stages,
that point.
Yeah.
Just seeing him there. And and so that was like quite of an amazing sense of behaviour and what we all did. And my brother very much took on sort of the father role in the family, as they do. And my sister sort of just totally shut down. So we had different stages
of course, between the three of us. And the thing is, when you're young, you know, she's 14.
Yeah.
And I think I had this well, like being 15, if there's some, my brother was 19. So like I could shut down and I could do other stuff because I can see him doing that. So everybody's other reactions enables you to do something else because you're like, well, I guess I can just be quiet because they seem to be all talking. So I don't need to say anything.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Everything right, I can just be ignored.
You can all do it.
Yeah, and it seems like you guys are doing it.
So. Yeah, and I think that's probably where a lot of my, you've talked about it definitely, the sort of becoming a fixer and
yeah,
I can help people and I can do that thing because...
Obsessed with it. How can I fix it? How can I fix
how
it?
How can I... You're not. You're unhappy. Can I...
Let's I mean, this podcast is just literally like, how can I fix my grief and everyone else's grief? I fixed it.
I did it.
Yay.
I'm going to walk out feeling great.
Oh, yeah. And then when I still have... it's funny to talk about being honest. I had a really shit night last night. Like, just I'm coming up to 20th anniversary and I was like, the irony of like, if you'd asked me 5 episodes ago, I would have been like, you know what? I think my grief is really fine. Like, I just talk about it all the time. I'm so cool with it. And then he's like, slam, you know? You can't fix
no.
It. It's just a process.
Yeah. And even when I was going through, just like chatting to my mum and being like, so what happened? And at one point we're just sobbing, talking about it. And then we're sort of finding we're talking about stuff. And it's never not going to be an inherently sad, horrific thing to go through. And grief is that. And it's a process. And I think it will always depend on what you've gone through in your life and how you can deal with it. And I think the interesting thing is I was talking to my friend about it this morning, actually. There were 8 of us that lost a parent in my school year.
Wow.
And then probably 15 of us that lost within my year above and year below. Wow. It was really, I don't know what was in the water in when I was growing up. But
I had there was in my like theatre studies class, there was 3 girls who lost their dad out of like, there was only like 9 of us in the class. But we would all shoot each other looks when people would say something like, yeah, you get it.
Yeah,
like,
you know.
Yeah. And somebody would be like, yeah, but why? Like, if my parents, and you'd be like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
And I wonder as well, like, sometimes I think people think, like, I'm still banging on about it or I'm still upset. And when I was trying to find the right therapist, it took me a while. Mm. And I remember one therapist being like, I mean, look how upset you are. And I was like, I'm a performer. Like, it is my job to get up this upset about stuff. Like, it's my job to have emotions this close at all times. And it sounds like such a wanky thing to say. Mm. But I remember feeling, like, worried, or like, do you have this, of, like, the fact that you can still sit and sob about it.
Mm.
And then sometimes people go, oh, she's not over it. You're like, no, it's just, no. I can just really remember feeling sad very clearly.
It's just allowing, that was one thing, obviously, just going to speak to a therapist was such an incredible...
Yeah. So when did you go? You went early.
I went early. I went quite early
you
on.
Got straight on that therapy train.
I was straight on. Never looked back. She was like, another Jewish person. Come on in.
Welcome. I'm going to get 14 years out of this.
Oh, hey. But I've seen 3. No, there's 4, I'm thinking about it. Nothing happened. They went like, didn't pick up the phone. Oh, God, it's hard. Uh-huh. Girl, come on. So I went to see one straight who was at my GP's. Because basically I started having nightmares about it all, which you do.
Well, because it's so traumatic.
And there was like specific things that sort of happened on when my dad was sort of, when we went back to the hospital that we'd seen. And I think I was just having like, you know, PTSD sort of flashbacks of stuff. And that was probably the first time I think I just couldn't sleep. Again, these are things I try and remember, but I just remember this, that she gave me this incredible thing that worked, really. Basically, so imagine the image and imagine it black and white. And then imagine, so think about that image and now imagine it in black and white. And now imagine you watching the image on telly on a black and white TV. Now imagine you watching yourself watching the image on telly and a black and white TV. And it's about like removal, you're distancing and removing. But because if she was like, I'm going to make you remove and put distance between it, I'd be like, well, you can't because I can't stop thinking about it. But it was it was just one thing I really remember her saying that I was like, oh, that's exactly.
That's helpful, yeah.
And so then I started to see her, and then I saw somebody at drama school, when I was at drama school, And I remember being like, this is the best thing ever. Oh my God, this is the best thing ever. Why are we not all doing this? And then...
Oh, that old chestnut. Oh. Everyone should do therapy because I'm fixed. I can fix you. Here's my idea. My idea is we all get therapy.
Yeah, I am peak mental fitness. It's great. But that was really helpful. And then I went through a bit of a sad, bit of a breakdown time about 3 years ago. And then remember being like, I can talk about, you know, normally I'd be like, oh, I can talk about all the things that are really hard, and then just wouldn't go and see anybody. Mm. And then had a coffee with a mate who basically shook me and was like, come on, like, you need to. And then I remember sort of taking a couple of days off. I was like doing like a muggle job, like teaching job or something. And then went and got a massage, bought some of like vitamins from Holland & Barrett and Google searched therapists and found one and went to see her. And that was then it just enabled me to have a bit more of a conversation about it. And the reason why I probably share this is because I, very long story short, had like a bit of like health problems with like my stomach, like was getting tested for celiac disease and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, you thought you were dying, right?
Thought.
Of course.
I was dying. And I thought I was dying, obviously, because not normally when I'll be like, oh, I just hit my head and now I have a brain tumour.
Yeah.
But I went for a scan, like on my bowels, my intestines, basically just like a regular, we're just going to have a look inside and see if anything's going on.
Yeah.
And the nurse, I was lying on the bed and the nurse went, just going to scan your tummy, blah, 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 blah.
Oh, God.
Oh.
Oh, God.
Oh, okay. And I went, whoa.
What was that?
And she was like, oh, I don't really know. There's something there, but I'm not sure. I'll just send these off to whatever and, like, I'll give you a call.
Whoa, bitch. Get your scan, get the x-ray, get everyone in now, the hospital. Clearly I'm dying and you don't want to tell me.
Come on now. And she was like, no, it's fine. So I left. Oh, Lewisham Hospital and started saying goodbye to everything.
Yeah.
And that weekend, like, phoned my mum. My mum was like, oh, calm down now. And I was like, no, I think I'm fine. But then what was actually happening was I just started seeing Stuart as well. Oh, my God. And I was like, well, this is it. This is the end.
Happiness is not good for us. We don't like it when happiness comes along. Because it can be taken away.
Yeah.
So here is this, oh, great. I know what comes with happiness. It gets snatched away from you guys.
And you're going to die because you've just got it.
Because that's what happens to me.
So I was like walking around. We went for a walk around Victoria Park and I was saying goodbye. It's like, goodbye, trees. Goodbye.
I mean, there's nothing like an actress with death anxiety. We really know how to do
we
it.
We know. Yeah. Goodbye. This is spaghetti bolognese would be the last meal I'll ever have, for I would die.
The pasta's so tender. I've never appreciated Parmesan shavings before.
Then I tried to just be really destructive and was just trying to break up with Stuart all the time. Yeah. And was like, no, I won't. And then he'd be like, yeah. So we're going to go, should we go out? And be like, yeah, okay. Like, I was like,
sorry about those other times.
I tried to break up with you. And I think that was obviously then sort of speaking to my therapist at the time and the one that I have now. So my then therapist then retired.
Oh, not, how annoying.
I know. And I was like, hello. Because then with like... anxiety, you have like abandonment things where you think because of
literally every time she says she starts the session, I think she's gonna say she's going because I don't want her to go. One time she said to me, I want you to know I'm not going anywhere, and I was like, okay, cool. Like, I felt like, oh, she had to tell me because she could tell,
she could tell
I was being weird about
So that was so she like was like, oh, I'm retiring, and I was like, no.
That would send me crazy.
Yeah.
Retiring, I'd be like,
why?
Why? I need you. And basically, because in your head, what you hear retiring is you're dying.
Yeah.
You just turn into they're dead. I'll never see them again.
She just wants to go and work in her allotment and have a lovely life. Yeah. She doesn't want to talk to people about death anymore. And then I found my new therapist. So
that's good. You got a new one.
She's great.
She's fresh, young.
She's a bit older.
Okay,
she is
not retiring age.
Incredible. And
good.
I keep she's amazing and like the best and like just brilliant and really bolshy and just in a way that I think like I can talk to her about stuff and she'll sort of be emotional about it with me, like she emotes in this, and I just feel like with therapists it is a you have to try. You have to go and meet loads.
I say it so much. You've got to shop around.
You do. And don't take the best deal.
Yeah, I was put off because I had this sort of couple attempts in my 20s when I went to, you know, I had like one session with one woman, I think, and then I think I tried again. And it literally made me so annoying when you're, I don't mean bragging, but like when you're a smart person.
Yeah.
If something doesn't work, you go, oh, well, I've tried it, it doesn't work. And I listen to podcasts and I hear people go, oh, yeah, well, therapy's not for me. And I'm like, nah, that's like saying comedy isn't for me. Yeah. Or I hate films because the only thing you've seen is, you know, Big Mama's House. No offence, Big Mama's House. I haven't even seen you.
That is a good basis of some comedy.
Yeah. Like, or, you know, like if you've... When people slag off anything, like you're like, well, you just haven't. I just think maybe you didn't try it properly.
Didn't try hard enough.
And I know it's so hard and it's expensive. I'm fucking lucky I got mine on the NHS, but that was purely by just waiting it. And if you've waited 18 years to talk to someone, because they said to me there's a massive waiting list, I was like, dude, I've been waiting. I don't mind. I'll just wait.
I can do another 6 weeks.
I'll just wait another year. Like, it's fine.
Yeah.
But I wasn't in crisis, as I know some people are. But I really think. Once you've, it's like a good partner. When you find someone, you're like, oh, this is so great.
Yeah.
Like, you do have to shop around.
I think you do. And I think it, oh, God, it's your health.
But, you know, it's not for everybody. Some people don't need it, and that's totally cool.
No, and some
might. You think you might need it.
But I think also everybody, it should be offered to, you know, I think it's a care thing, and it's a, you go through a trauma of losing somebody. And I think to be able to talk to somebody is, you know, we can sit here and talk about it. And, you know, obviously I know a lot of people who listen to this podcast will be like, even just hearing other people talk about it and going, oh my God, me too. That's a thing I think about is helpful. But to go and actually, my therapist helps me pinpoint stuff on a daily basis and gives me tips. So it's not like I'll go to her and go, oh, I think this thing today, and she'll just listen. So I was having a bit of a, I generally am, you know, good and now can make work about talking about it, and that's more what my show is about, as opposed to just sitting crying for an hour. Sit there, but home. But I couldn't see her, for example, for like 2 or 3 weeks, and just for whatever was going on, like I was away, and I then just could think about the sort of things that she would advise me to do.
Yeah.
So, for example, Stu went on a huge bike ride across France and Germany. And
oh, what is he trying to do to
he
you?
Is testing
Jesus Christ
with a friend's
bike, he's in front of a mountain, water's gonna come off.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was like, went to a therapy session, I was like, so Stu's doing this thing and I'm fine about it. But
absolutely fine,
like totally fine that he can do that, and you know, he's on a bike and he's vulnerable and might die, and he might, all the things might happen, let alone just walking along the street and just having a heart attack. Now we might be on his bike doing it. And she was like, okay, so obviously you're not fine. Why don't you sit down with him and talk to him about all the possible things? And so because I have all these levels of anxiety and still, you know, function day to day, fine. The way is about managing it. It's about going, what do I need to do? So what I do is I list all the worst possible things that can happen. Because then if I can list them and I can get them out there, I can hear how daft they are.
Yeah,
so even like asking friends to text me and go, I'm not dead. They're not, it's never with a serious note. And I never read that and go, oh my God, thank God. But just receiving, just knowing that, it's almost like, humour me for a second.
Yeah.
Say these things to me.
My favourite CBT, because I did CBT as well, is they've said you have to say the worst thing, the best thing, and then the middle.
Oh, okay.
Oh,
yeah.
This is so good. So then I'd be like, okay, so I've imagined that they've died.
Yeah.
The best thing, they come home with chocolate and I'm over the moon. The middle thing is they just come home.
Walk through the door.
And that to me made me really go, because again, like I'm obsessed with like narrative. I'm like, well, that's actually the most believable narrative.
Yeah.
Like that's actually, and because I like evidence, I'm like, well, what normally happens? They normally just come through the door.
Yeah.
So I found that when I'm in a real state of like, oh God, well, you know, where are they? What's happening? I'm like, okay, worst case scenario. And I can imagine that. Like, yeah, I mean, that's a Hollywood film version.
Yeah.
Best case scenario takes me quite a while. What would be good? How would I make that good?
What's my day to day?
Add chocolate. Somehow he's got chocolate or flowers or sugar. He's just carrying a bowl of sugar. I just eat it. I just shove my head in it. So I enjoy that.
Yeah.
And then the average, what, like, and it's helped me with anxiety for, because I have social anxiety as well. So if I'm like, okay, what's the worst thing that happened? You walk into the party, they spit on your face, everybody spits on your face, and then they all line up in a line to tell you how shit you are. And then they just all point at you and laugh until you leave, and they just they literally just all laugh. You're getting anxious now.
No, I'm loving it, yeah.
Best case scenario, like you come in, they start carrying you around the party. People start chanting your name, people start crying because they want to tell you how amazing you are. These are great scenarios.
Yeah.
No, what's middle? You're like, I'll come in, I'll speak to the people I know, I'll have an all right time, probably better than I think, and I'll go home.
Yeah.
And that calms me down so much. Yeah. I'm like, actually, both the best and worst are very stressful.
Yeah, and which one? And so, also, so in my show, I play a game called Worst Possible Situation with audience members. Oh, so I get them up on stage
amazing.
And we do that. So I'll give them a scenario and they will help me to think of the worst thing, and they have to make it worse. So we play a game of making it worse.
Amazing.
And what that does for me is then really highlight the levels of how much our brains are trying to protect us, and also how much our brains are trying to... So I look at something called the amygdala, which is the fight or flight.
Sure.
Oh, yeah,
oh,
you're
yeah,
there.
Babes, yeah.
So that is your fight or flight thing, and mine is really overactive, so which is why what happened... And obviously for me, I looked at getting CBT, but when I spoke to the doctor was like, but when you do CBT, you can't go and still see your therapist because CBT is about moving forward and looking forward.
Right.
And I quite like going and being like, back in the day, Lindsay.
I did CBT when there wasn't a therapist.
Yeah, yeah.
So they were like, we can offer you 6 sessions of CBT as we talked about on Bobby's episode, which I found super helpful. But again, I would say, it definitely, I remember speaking to a friend about this and he was like, yeah, CBD is great for like getting through the day, but then sometimes you might need, why is this happening?
Yeah.
But everybody's different. But I really found CBT so useful as a stepping stone to being brave enough to talk about things. I was that idea of having therapy, different therapists over a long amount of time. Again, I think I've only just started realizing that when you lose someone young, as you get older, your relationship changes to them, even though they're not there.
Yeah.
So of course you might need therapy at different stages, and you I think sometimes it's easy to think, oh yeah, but that was ages ago. It's like, yeah, but Lauren now is a different person to Lauren at 17.
Definitely.
And I'm saying that as if it's not me. But that Lauren now needs to reconcile her relationship with her father now as an adult.
Yeah.
Like that's everything I'm having to go through because you're trapped as a teenager.
Yeah, it's almost like that. There's a part of your brain and your body that... And sometimes it feels like that when I behave or react about certain situations, but everybody does. I don't think anybody acts like a grown-up.
Do you react like a teenager though?
Yes.
Yeah, same. Do you feel like I feel like if I see a teenager, I'm like, yeah, I get you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm like, if I see someone being particularly, I'm like, yeah, cool, that makes perfect sense. Your that attitude, the behaviour.
That's how that sort of, I developed a lot of anger, and I obviously sort of read a lot. I don't know where that, thanks Julia. Julia explains about how the anger is sort of displaced, and I'm sort of so much better, but you know, I was a very stroppy teenager and sort of have come through a lot of stuff to become a less stroppy adult. But there are still moments when I deal with, I mean, it's all learned behaviour from family and parents, and where you learn about how people react and behave about sort of stuff or whatever's going on. But I just feel like we're coming into contact with new things in our lives constantly. And it might not necessarily be linked to the grief of my father, the death of my father, but it might be linked to other behaviours or reactions I encountered since then that I was doing like a defence mechanism. So things like, I want to have children or a child, don't know, maybe two. however,
just
I can
get one
afford
way,
just do one.
That's how I've learned. You're like, I have five. No, just have one.
Just
and see,
one.
See how you feel.
And a dog. And that obviously is not going to happen in the next sort of 6 months or something, but at the state where we're starting to think about it, then I've got to overcome a lot of hurdles about I can't react in the way that I would normally react, and how will I deal with that, and how will I deal with also just allowing... Best piece of advice ever my therapist said was just be kind to yourself, and it is the best piece of advice because it just meant there's a lot of levels I think about feeling like you don't deserve nice things or certain ways in which because you've had to go through a certain thing, or you think somebody's going to go, or you know,
I think it's just it's definitely a destroying happiness
thing. I think so.
It seems to happen, and I can't quite put my therapist says, I was like, no one's quite put their finger on why the fact that our dads died as teenagers makes us somehow go, well, I think it's not trusting it, isn't it? I don't trust happiness in a way that because I somehow trust pain.
Well, if the big hot, the scare was you just living your life and then something crap happens, then you feel like that even on smaller levels. Like, I'm scared. One of my biggest things I'm scared about getting married, social situations are horrendous for me. Yeah. You, when you said what's your best and your worst, my best would be that nobody, I don't want people carrying me around the room. I want people being like, oh, hey, I don't want like all of that, like big. But for me, getting married, I'm terrified that I might projectile vomit at my own wedding.
I love what your brain does to you. Mine was falling over. Oh. I was like convinced that I could just imagine myself constantly falling over, like flat on my face. And then eventually I was like, Carrie, that would be such a weird, that would be such an unusual thing for a bride to be unable to stand. It'd be mad. Like, what? People wouldn't be laughing at you, or they'd just think, God, this poor woman, what the hell is going on?
Yeah.
And same projectile, like, that would be so strange.
Well, I've done it once. And I've done it once when I had my first kiss and I was really sick because I was so nervous.
Oh, and like, bless you.
It's ridiculous, but, you know, it's like, let's take a nice thing and then this.
Yeah, then imagine how
you could ruin it. And I worry so much about love, you know, if a nice thing happens, I'll always think about the worst thing. But I am a fun person to be. I'm a fun person to be around.
I'm super fun. But there's just a lot of stuff going on up here that most people don't know about.
Yeah.
I think I'm quite good. I think both, because I would never know from you. Oh, like, it's kind of you saying anxious, like, especially when I met you and never would have thought you were an anxious person. Yeah. Just thought, oh, she seems nice.
Yeah. So
nice person.
So level. And probably the same, didn't know. There's so many people that I'll be like, and I found that about when I've talked about anxiety and the links to it, and sort of really celebrating being neurodiverse and being like, this is the way our brains are, and we'll try to deal with them in the best ways that we can. But instead of sort of covering it up, and that's what's so lovely about the more people that talk about mental health and the links to it. And I know that for me, it's kind of going, somebody said, oh, you know, if you were fully cured of all your things, how would I was like, maybe I wouldn't be the person I would be today if this hadn't happened or this hadn't happened. And I have to think about moving forward.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's what the good thing about therapy is about, is that it helps you maintain your everyday. And then also I'm able to put, because my family are quite, have a dark sense of humour since probably definitely my dad died. And we say things like, when we used to go to the grave and see my dad, and I'd come home and be like, oh, yeah, I went to see Dad. Mum would be like, how was he? And I'd be like, oh, quiet. But
didn't say much. No change there.
Oh, he's quite cold. I don't know. But things that become a normality within a coping mechanism and using comedy to sort of talk about the things that are difficult in order that you can go, hey, this is crap, but if we... It's almost like laughing about it helps me gain power over a lot of the sad. And I think that's one of the things that I am so thankful that I found an outlet to be able to talk about it, and then also go...
And now do the clowning and doing the show.
Yeah, and it's sort of like when I'm on stage and sort of performing and talking about death, or if I've talked about death anxiety, to make light about it, because if I don't, I would just go... And I still do constantly think, oh, all these terrible things are going to happen. Mm. But then if I replay, like you said, all the scenarios, then it does make it easier to talk about. Yeah. And I think
Do you talk about your dad in the show, or is it more about...
No, I don't. I've sort of it's mentioned, but I don't talk about it too much. I don't sort of label it too much because I do talk about the fact that sort of having people losing me, but it's something I'm still like I'm writing about and thinking about making a show, because it doesn't center mainly on death anxiety. It's the show is social and anticipation with a bit of sprinkling of death.
Sprinkling of death anxiety.
But thinking of like the next, like another project that I'm working on at the moment about death anxiety, using clowning and sort of comedy for that, is to me, and how a friend of mine who's part of the Good Order of the Good Death that we've talked about, and really trying to push on being like death positive, I think it's so much a part of our life.
The thing that I've started to think about death positive, because it's funny, because obviously like most people are like hashtag body positivity and now you're like, hey, guess what, death's got involved. It's a little bit more complicated, the hashtag, but there is this hashtag death positive.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about it, and I was like, I think it must be a common thing. Someone dies, you get anxious. Mm. It gives you this anxiety about the instability of the world. But gaining strength from knowing it will happen to everybody, yeah, and trying to stop it being like the big bad wolf, which I think is probably what both you and I have of like, yeah, oh, it's the worst thing that can, yeah, happen. And being like, no, it's just going to happen.
Yeah.
And just trying to let that be part of our narratives rather than like, keep that fucking thing out the door, like bolt it. So just, yeah, stay in your room, never leave. Forever.
Yeah. And it's where your levels of anxiety sort of sit with, like, whether I'm scared about dying, but I kind of feel like if I knew, then I would probably have an understanding of it. It's more sort of the control of other people. I don't know what I would think, but we need to talk about it because we need to be able to be prepared. And the worst possible thing that we would know is if somebody, God forbid, like, dies out of the blue and they've not sorted anything, they've not done anything.
We always talk about this.
And making sure that we've got everything in order. My mum will phone me and be like, hi, so I know you don't really want to talk about it, but here's all the information that, yeah, you're going to need. And I'm like, I don't want to really hear this. Don't make me an orphan. But then mum, eventually I know, and we've talked about it a bit, but now I know that these are the conversations that need to be had.
Yeah.
And being control freaks, the, yeah, more we can talk about it, the more we can be prepared, so that then you just have to deal with the emotional side of it without having to worry about all the other bits, you know, with, oh my God, what are we going to do? And with, it's a bigger thing, but like with Jewish burial, it happens immediately.
Yeah,
so it's like,
yeah,
the next day. And it's all about basically getting them buried as quick as possible so that you can deal with the grieving process.
Oh, is that kind of where it comes from? Like, yeah, get them in and then that bit's done.
Do it. It's not about, you know, it's about being together. And so, even though my dad died on the 29th and his funeral was on the 30th, there were 300 people at his funeral.
Wow.
Within less than 24 hours. Like, he was an amazing guy, like a real positive, like just a real man, like a real character and a, yeah, real people person, and everybody knew him, and he was extraordinary and made a lot of friends and people really loved him. So lots of people knew him, and we sort of, what Jewish burial enables you to do is sort of the funeral happens and they're buried and it sort of happened immediately. And then you do something called, you sit shiva, which is basically the week of mourning where you sit on low chairs and you have a piece of clothing that's ripped. Like, it's all about suffering, really. It's all like, but basically what it is that you're buried, and then, yeah, then we come back to the house and you all talk. And I chatted to the rabbi about it last week. Hey, rabbi. And he was sort of explaining to me sort of the whole process of what happens. But mainly, the idea is to come home and think about that person and talk about that person, yeah, together and share things. And the people that sit shiva are the immediate, it's called sitting shiva, and the people, it's children, parents and spouse and brothers and sisters. Like, and my dad didn't have any family, really. We had a step-grandfather, but he didn't sit shiva. So it's my mum and my brother and sister and I. And we all sat for the week. And basically you sit on low chairs because it's meant to be uncomfortable.
Wow.
So all these things. And we're Orthodox, but we're not practicing, really. I'm definitely not. But you sort of do it in, because that's what we did. My dad wasn't really. He used to, like, we used to go to the synagogue on a Saturday. My grandparents, he'd pick us up and take us to KFC. You know. But we, so you, yeah, you all sit and you're meant to sit there all day, and the guys aren't allowed to shave, and you have to cover up all the mirrors, mm, and anything of reflective. It's all about just focusing in and thinking about that person and being with your family and sharing stories. And it's almost like the most cathartic thing, because that's all I've ever known. That's within growing up, with the amount of funerals that happened and the amount of people that died, going to so many of them, death being just always present,
mm,
knowing that that is the time that people talk and mourn. I can't imagine 2 weeks going by without with having that, you know, not having a person buried. And it's just comparison. I suppose it's just...
Well, I love a ritual. I love hearing about them because I do just think they're there for a reason. Like, it's not... Like, if a society had something that wasn't useful, they would have got rid of it.
Yeah.
Like, if, you know, I don't know, 2200 BC, someone would have been like, this is... You know that thing where we punch each other? I think we could lose it. I just don't know if it's working for me. And then someone's like, but the low chairs, I love the low chairs. Yeah. Keep the low chairs. Do you know what I mean? So these things have lasted the test of time because they help humans cope.
Yeah.
And I do think... I mean, my dad's funeral was great and amazing, you know, and we did sit around and talk, but to have that kind of... It reminds me of school. It's like sometimes school did stuff that you didn't want to do, but you sort of knew it was good for you.
Yeah.
And when a higher power is in charge, you're like, well, we kind of have to sit shiver, like, you know.
Yeah,
you've got to do it.
Yeah.
So then even if you were left to your own devices, you might go, do you know what, I don't feel like it. But that might not be the best thing for you.
Yeah.
That's sort of what I imagine. Is like, actually, probably if they said 17-year-old Lauren, you have a choice, you might be like, oh, I want to be with my friends. I don't want to do this.
Yeah, and actually it forced you to be in the room and... It, you know, there were shared jokes and things probably within the family where we would know that person would come and do the head on the side tilt of, I'm so sorry, and we'd probably count how many, like, all the weird sort of grieving things. But what it did do is enable us and enables us to talk and to share and to basically just sit together, as much as it wasn't easy. And there were, you know, we would... dealt with it in our own, my brother and sister and I, my mum all dealt with it in different ways, but what it did do was just rally a community around us to go, it's cool, right, all you have to do is not much, is just to sit here and think about him and share lovely memories. And because I think we had, it wasn't for us maybe an immediate shock, but even if I suppose it is, it forces you to sort of, it doesn't solve everything, but it does force you to talk. And then it sort of goes on that, if depending on who's died, you could be mourning for a year, you're not allowed to like listen to music or go to weddings or go to celebration. It depends for Judaism, it depends sort of who it is, if it's a spouse or a parent. But for us, we did a week where we all sat there and then it sort of finished. My mum got her house back and like, you know, people weren't in the house all the time, and it just enabled us to just all be together.
Lauren, he sounds like an amazing man.
He was.
And it sounds like you've been through an incredible process and come through the other side, whatever that means.
Yeah.
Because we know it's still, you're still walking it.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for coming to talk to me.
Thank you very much, Kerry.
You can follow Lauren on Twitter at HeyLaurenSilver, or you can go to her website, laurensilver.co.uk. She's also performing in Edinburgh this summer. She'll be doing Wild Creatures and the Canterville Ghost at 2:45 p.m. every day at The Pleasance. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast, or you can email us thegriefcast@gmail.com. Music was provided by The Glue Ensemble, and the show was edited by Kate Holland, with thanks to Whistledown Studios. And remember, you are not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.